Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
And good morning, everybody. Happy Wednesday. It is the a question on everyone's mind this morning, especially my mind. If I asked you, Kristen, should a president of the United States care about citizens, Americans, voters, in some cases, what their financial situation is? Isn't there always a right answer on that?
I feel like the answer should always be yes, mm-hmm. even if it is more nuanced as far as the other things as, along with safety and future expectations, et cetera, is baked into that. But I think, yes, you should be caring about how many people are struggling in this economy.
So the president was essentially asked that direct question yesterday.
He was, and this was his answer.
When we're negotiating with Iran, Mr. President, to what extent are Americans' financial situation motivating you to make a deal?
Not even a little bit. The only thing that matters when I'm talking about Iran, they can't have a nuclear weapon. I don't think about Americans' financial situation. I don't think about anybody. I think about one thing. We cannot let Iran have a nuclear weapon. That's all. That's the only thing that matters.
So, go ahead.
I was going to say, I feel like that will be, if it's the first time you're hearing that clip today, I'm guessing it's not, but if it is, you will be, you can for sure be expecting to see that clip again and again and again during midterms.
So Republican and conservative defenders of the president on this specific talking point basically say he's talking about Iran, not the economy. He's basically saying, in the context of the Iran having a nuclear weapon, I don't care about anything else. That's how they're defending his comments.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're trying to add, and I do think that's probably true. I think
for the president,
He's deciding, when he is questioning and making decisions about this war, I want to take him at his word that he's not thinking about. Well, but that's also, I don't know if that's true, because think about just a couple of weeks ago, like the Easter tweet or bleat or whatever, as far as open the effing strait and understanding that the impact of the strait being closed is hurting him politically because of the cost of everything is going up. I mean, inflation has now officially erased wage gains for the first time in 3 years. And this is also on top of the fact that individual hurting financially, but the U.S. debt, we haven't even talked about this when this news broke back in March, but the U.S. debt now exceeds the country's GDP.
Mm-hmm.
And
this president, in his two terms, one and a half terms, has doubled the national debt.
And I feel like you think back to the messaging and marketing of the Iraq War back in 2003 and the playing cards and the unity around that. And granted, it was a very different time, but there was a plan to message to the American people on why we needed to do this. And with this war, there's been no communication that has convinced us that this takes priority over your pocketbook, right? And you can see that in all the polling, right? There's two out of 10 Americans think this is worth it. And there has been no real stakes communicated for people to understand that the short-term hurting that's happening right now is worth the long-term safety of this plan. And so it is just wildly unpopular. And I don't even know, with all of the redistricting that's happening, if that's going to save him come the fall.
Clearly he's hanging his hat on that, because his polling is as bad as a president's ever had on any economic issue. He's so far underwater. And I will remind supporters of the president and the administration, this is a president who said gas would be half as much, energy costs would be half as much, prices would be way down, life would be better. He's ending wars, not starting wars. And almost every measure, almost every word or statement this president has made in this second term, 2.0 of the Trump administration, he's been wrong on it. His actions, tariffs, military, and now his policies related to the economy in general, and his sort of his over fixation on acknowledgments of his power like Oval Office, White House renovations, ballroom, arch, whatever else he's got up his sleeve, the reflecting pool that he handed a, what was a $7 billion contract, now up to, I think, 13 is the latest number. They're not even half done yet, trying to just paint the surface of this thing, not to mention try to fix what's not working there. So on every one of those measures, he's failed, at least at this moment. So to going to your point, the election, other than rigging the election, which is the very thing that some people think people did to him in the last election, I don't know how he gets out of this. But America surprises us sometimes, and maybe he's still popular.
Well,
I don't know.
Think that's my question to the audience, for people who do support him, have supported him, or have close, you know, loved ones who have supported him. Like, is this changing your tune? Because there's that ongoing meme as far as the line continuously to move for people who support Trump. But if you are someone who is financially hurting and have not seen an improvement in your life in the last 15 months and potentially have seen it get worse, is this enough for you to walk away from this administration and take a chance on a Democrat? Because that ultimately is the thing, right?
Right.
It's not only...
What's the alternative?
On a poll where it's easy to answer a question is very different than how you end up voting at all or potentially leaving your party that you normally vote for and vote for the other party.
And since I'm the Republican in the room, generally speaking, I want to hear from people who were Trump supporters, Trump voters, if he has crossed that line for you, whether that was the economy, whether the military action, whatever decision, whether it's conduct. I mean, I've never seen a president send out such twisted messages on occasions like Mother's Day and Easter that aren't really the essence of what the holiday is about, and then twist them into some weird political thing, name calling. Like, just on the conduct thing, I'm offended by it as an American.
Well, you also, I mean, you brought it up even before I did, despite me being a woman, is, you know, again, yesterday being as rude as he is to female reporters.
Yeah, he selectively picks them out.
Stupid.
Stupid and dumb are the words he used yesterday. And I'll even challenge my friends. I'm not a journalist, and you don't call yourself a journalist, so you do a lot of work in that area. And work for a newspaper. Why isn't there more people upset about that? The treatments of women, and was the father of two daughters, and someone I think who understands the importance of treating all of us the same way, regardless of gender, right? Gender equality. This president is picking out these women who are actually, by the way, some pretty good journalists, right? Caitlin Collins, pretty good at her job.
Thick skin.
Somehow she laughs this stuff off. To my journalist friends, I'm not seeing a lot of defense on your side, so it's sort of a side story there. But anyway, has he crossed that line with you as a voter? And if
are
not,
you willing to vote? If you're a Republican voter,
would you be willing to
vote?
Are
you willing to vote for a Democrat this fall?
Even better. All right, we'll take a break, a late break, first break on Point Taken on 620 WTMJ. Thanks for joining us on this Wednesday edition of Point Taken. Kristen Bride, Steve Spidion, 620 WTMJ. If you missed any or all of our show or shows, interviews, some of the topics that we discuss, you can find them all on our podcast page at WTMJ.com, or just search Point Taken podcast wherever you get your podcast, and they'll take you right there. And we always appreciate those folks. And often, many times, people find our content later, and then they send us feedback and questions. I love that. And we now have a new way to sort of do these, since it's Wednesday, the Ask Us Anything. Just text ASK, 855-616-1620. Send us a question. We get to it in a separate podcast over time. We mix it into some of the other stuff we do. So it's an interesting way to sort of answer the feedback directly. If you got a good one or a funny one, we might tee it up.
We might make it into a video.
You might, like we did last week with the zombie question and the subject of cults.
Got a lot of texts. We were asking the question as of yesterday, Trump said he's not thinking at all about the financial health of Americans when he's making decisions about the Iran war, and that his singular focus is that Iran does not get a nuclear weapon. And in right now, I think what the headline from Axios this morning was the five-alarm economy, or Trump's five-alarm economy. There's a lot of people not doing well. And so my question becomes, it's one thing to answer on a survey as far as Trump's now, I think, 70% disapproval rating when it comes to the economy. But does that change your vote? And we're getting some texts in right now. And I said from the 414, I hear your points, but... The Democrats can't find a candidate that can even speak. Also, the stock markets and my 401k have never been better. Both sides suck. And so that's my question. It's like, it's different to answer a poll than actually think that the other side's going to do better.
Because one's talking, one's action.
And so this one's heartbreaking from the 920. I was a Trump voter very reluctantly. I am so financially tight right now, ended up with food poisoning last week. This week, I'm struggling to put extra gas in my car or feed my family. My electric bill and a budget has turned $550. I can't afford to be sick, and I can't afford to go to work. It's so upsetting. I literally lie awake at night stressing about how I'm going to pay my bills, and I already have two jobs.
This goes to something that we were talking about, Carmen Petrie, about people's ability to think about other people. I think when you say, some people say, in this case it's not that, but some people say, I'm good. This president's doing it for me. So do those people just disregard the rest of the population? Because I don't know if you're a person of faith, and a lot of people are in this country, you would generally want to think about your fellow man and want them to succeed, them to do well. And it's this line for me is, you say all these things, you hear all these things in your place of worship, and then you get out of your place of worship and you're just a different animal, different human being. You don't care. And that stuff drives me nuts. So I'm very sensitive to that. Here's another one. And to the texter who said, read some of these texts. They're fascinating texts because it's a glimpse, real life, real time, into what people are thinking. This is from the 715. My father, who was very MAGA, has voted for Trump 3 times. He continues to just blame Dems despite his ability to recognize the president's failures. He has said he would never vote for a liberal or Dem solely because of the party label.
Yeah.
Here's another one. 715. Different number. My father, who's a Trump supporter and very staunch Republican my entire life, actually said to me a week or so ago, that he wished Trump would shut his effing mouth. So I'm not sure if this has changed his voting pattern, but it sure has changed his opinion of Trump. That one, I'll give you. That has changed. Because I have friends who are big Trump supporters. They're like, they're tired of the nonsense. But again, it all comes down to what's the alternative. Now, go ahead.
There's 262. I did not vote for Trump. I left the choice for President blank. I wish one of the choices was none of the above.
Yeah.
I would not vote for a Democrat if you put a gun to my head.
See, that's the challenge.
Now, that is a challenge.
Part of that's on Democrats, too. They have to figure that out.
And this is the point, right? As far as Democrats needing to give people something to vote for, to get in line, to have a platform, to have a plan. And because I think there are aggrieved voters who are not happy with what's happening, but are not convinced that things are going to get any better either way. Like, this isn't even just people, millennials, Gen X. This is what I'm hearing as I'm interviewing young people for the documentary, as just having values that align maybe left or maybe right, but not being super thrilled with their options when it comes to how the parties are actually governing.
This is where I get most, I shared some of my frustration with you this morning. When I see Democrats essentially using the Republicans' ideas and elected officials in Canada are evil, I'm simplifying it. They're not using the exact term. But when I see that, you're not helping yourself win over voters that we're talking about. They're going to disregard you because they're just worried that if you don't like who I am as a person, an individual, you think I'm evil, why would I ever vote for you? They have to somehow figure that out. If you're a Democrat, whether it's in Wisconsin, our races coming up, or in the country in midterms, this is a rare opportunity. The president has never been more unpopular in the history of our country. It's almost shocking to say that because this guy's pretty popular. Got a lot of votes in his second run. If you don't carpe diem, seize the moment, seize the day.
This is what's so frustrating as far as, and you know, there's something to be said as far as who saw the glimmer of hope that Trump could have a revival post January 6th, right? It was the Heritage Foundation and some of the conservative academics and those behind Project 2025. Like, he was wildly unpopular after January 6th, right? Mm-hmm. And so with a smaller tent, let's call it that, there was an ability to create a Project 2025. And now, once they had the momentum, get Trump reelected and start enacting a Project 2025. I think there is rumblings of different groups on the left who are trying to create some kind of Project 2020, what would it be, 9? But there's no consensus, right? And so I think this is the thing, because when you're a big tent, as far as what is the actual platform to make people's lives better and make government work for people, if they have it, they're not communicating it, they being Democrats.
Right.
And it is an opportunity right now, because there are so many aggrieved voters, to really put policy to work on what would actually improve people's stance in life and have it be a simple message that you ring again and again and up and down the ticket across the country, have people on the same page. And I just don't see that kind of consensus right
now. That's the frustrating part. We'll take a quick break. We're actually late for break. Point taken, Kristen and Steve, on this Wednesday edition right here on WTMJ. Texts continue to pour in. Matt says, where'd you go, Matt? This thing's moving pretty quick here. Where did Matt go now?
I got it. People want politicians to materially deliver. Dems need to rally around a common message. Economics is everything. I mean, I know you don't like the title, but Zoran Mamdani, like, that's why he won, right? That there was a fair amount of people who voted for both Trump in 24 and then turned around and voted for him the next year because there was an economic message. And, you know, I think, was it yesterday that they announced that they got their budget, their $12 billion budget deficit down to zero? And the state helped a lot, right? And that is people criticizing how they got that done and that Hochul wants to get
it reelected.
They got it done. But they got it done.
Ultimately, again, actions. If you can get it done, people will say, okay.
I mean, and that's something to say as far as his political prowess, because Hochul wasn't like a Mamdani fan off the bat. Like, when he was running, it wasn't like she was backing him. And so since he's been in office, what they've done, gotten done together, like, give some credit to him is his ability to work with her on that and get the money that they got from the state.
And on a list of things that make no sense, the president of the United States, Donald Trump, is actually a fan of him.
He's a charming guy.
Yeah.
Good-looking, totally charming guy. Trump likes good-looking people.
Apparently, because he always complains about Democrats and liberals. I mean, he's pretty liberal. All right, we're going to talk some education. Will Flanders from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty will join us live in studio. I think he's in the building. We'll talk about that. We'll certainly get some of the other big stories, right? Watertown, what's going on there?
School board. I have thoughts.
Kristen has thoughts. I do as well. We'll talk about all of that. When I had Rick... First of all, welcome to Point Taken with Kristen and Steve. When I had President of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, Rick Esterberg, on the show a couple of weeks ago while Kristen was off, working on all the things she works on when she's not doing our show, I said to him, hey, when's Will Flanders coming on the show? He's the smartest guy you have working there. And he sort of nodded and, you know. So joining us in the studio is
Did he not appreciate that? Does Rick think he's the smartest person working at Will?
Yeah, we got to downgrade me a little bit on the
Did
list
you have
there,
like an it's your office debate on is that going around the emails? No, Will Flanders, doctor at what is your doctorate in?
Political science and public policy. So
nice.
only tangentially related to the work that I do.
That's still impressive. and I've had Will on the show for years, my show and other shows. So you guys always do some interesting work, and one of the things you've done recently is a documentary on why teachers leave in the state of Wisconsin. And as someone who's married to a teacher, she's got thoughts. I shared the clip with her, and she has different thoughts than you have. But so give us, I'll tell you what she said in a second, but give us your takeaways from what you gleaned, your company, your organization, what they gleaned from talking to teachers.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we know about the teacher shortage. We know about the problem of teacher retention, teachers leaving the workforce after not very long in the field. And this creates problems for districts around the state as well as for, you know, for schools across all sectors, right? So what we wanted to do was to talk to teachers on the ground and, you know, get their sort of firsthand perspective as to what they see as the issues in the classroom. And what we saw as to why teachers are leaving is one of the primary drivers is the problem of student discipline, the problem of student misbehavior in the classroom, and oftentimes that misbehavior not being rectified by administration. And there is some data to back that up nationally, right? There's a national survey from the NEA, so not some, you know, right-wing leaning organization at all, recently that said 80% of teachers see student behavior as a major problem. 44% of teachers said that's a major stressor, one of their biggest issues in the classroom. So that was backed up by some of what we saw in the interview.
So when
well.
We say behavior, let's get more specific. Like, what are we talking
sure.
about?
Yeah, so it can be a wide variety of things, right? But I think some of the main things are just classroom disruption. You know, you can get into the more serious things, like we had some teachers talk about actually facing violence in the classroom. But the day-to-day thing that I think wears teachers down the most many times is that students are just misbehaving, you know, talking out of turn, insulting each other, not listening to the lessons. And so that's probably the number one thing. Obviously, you get to more extreme things like violent behavior and things like that. that's on the margins. But when those things happen, obviously that's a maybe even bigger impetus towards towards leaving the classroom.
Get my mic on. One of the biggest testimonials that I gleaned from watching this was when a teacher said to me, one of the biggest things we just can't stand is when we remove a student for disciplinary reasons and they're set right back. Because it shows that other students that student one, that they're weak teachers. They don't have any control over their classroom. And that message, talking to my wife, she's had that happen to her in her career where you don't look very good when they just send them right back to the very problem they created.
Absolutely. There's two problems there. One is that the student obviously doesn't face any sort of disincentive for the
Nothing
misbehavior, right? Oftentimes they'll be sent back with a candy or some sort of almost a reward for the behavior that the behavior issues they've had. And secondly, it decreases the respect that the teacher has as an authority figure in the classroom. So not only does that student no longer necessarily feel the need to follow what the teacher says, but other kids in the classroom see that as well, and that can be a sort of driver towards further behavioral issues.
So is this something that we know over time has gotten worse? Because I know so often when we talked about coming out of COVID, like the antisocial behavior of both adults and students, sure. Right? Like a lot of us forgot how to act during that time. And so is this something that we've seen a rise in worse behavior in kids? Or is this, or the documentary that you guys did, is it mostly just getting testimony from teachers and basing it off of that?
So I think post-COVID, we certainly have seen an uptick, and it's probably more anecdotal than what we can show data-wise that there's been an uptick in behavioral issues. But and you're absolutely right. Kids that spent a year and a half at home didn't necessarily get socialized into the normal behavior in a classroom, and we have a generation of kids that missed out on that socialization period. So certainly seems to be an uptick post-COVID, though, you know, really you can trace this back a decade or more to where we've really been disincentivizing some of the stronger discipline practices that we used to see in schools, like utilizations of in-school systems. Suspensions, utilization of out-of-school suspensions, and any sort of harsher punishment. We've really sort of incentivized from the top down, from the federal government to the local governments and administrators within schools, disincentivized using some of those methods in general.
So if suspensions are down, and I think I've heard this before, right? Like different, I don't know, and I don't know how many in Wisconsin actually use this, but like meditation and yoga and trying to find like almost a social reform aspect to discipline. And again, I don't know how much that's utilized in Wisconsin, but is that what we're talking about as far as just like thinking that suspensions don't serve the child and so finding other ways and it's not working?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. So one of the big things across the state you'll see in school districts was the implementation of what's known as positive behavioral supports. And the notion there is that we try to be more rehabilitative, like sort of some of the things we've seen, you know, in prisons and jails as well over the years.
The description I heard from a school board member was keep them in the classroom.
Exactly, and that is the overall goal. And you know, there are positives to that, right? The first, you know, goal should be to keep students in the classroom when possible, but we also need to think about the sort of classroom as an environment as a whole. And oftentimes when we focus on the one kid, we're costing educational opportunities for the other 20 or 25 kids in the classroom by keeping that student in the classroom.
You can't teach when you have a disruption that's affecting all of the other students.
Absolutely.
And my wife's answer on this question, besides the behavior thing, which she certainly was aware of in her many years of teaching, was you ask a teacher or an ex-teacher, and they'll tell you it's salary and benefits.
So that's what I was going to say. It's like, is this actually, I'm not saying it's not an issue, in the myriad of issues that teachers are facing, as far as I think a lot of them would say, since Act 10, the respect for the profession has changed. What the salary is, what the benefits are, what the stress load is, feeling actually supported. So there's guns, right? Like there's a different safety issue altogether with that. So is this one of many, or are you guys trying to make the argument that this is the main driver of teachers leaving the profession?
No, I think it's certainly one of many.
Okay.
I mean, you know, some of the polling data that we've found, and there's a poll of MPS exit surveys, right, where the number one overall issue for teachers leaving the profession was personal safety, working conditions, lack of support and respect is part of that as well.
Yeah.
But all these things do sort of overlap. You know, in terms of salary, I think we're very sympathetic to the needs to work on raising teacher salaries. You know, one thing we like to point out is our average, you know, per pupil spending in the state now is $18,592 per student. If you take that with a class of 20 students, you're at almost $300,000 of value. So, you know, one thing to ask for teachers is, you know, where is that money going if not into their pockets? Sometimes it's been to a service with special needs services and things like that that actually stem from a lot of the discipline issues that we're seeing. But there is a lot of money in our schools. It's just not always ending up with the teachers.
Dr. Will Flanders, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. We'll take a quick break here. Continue the conversation after this on Point Taken, 620 WTMJ. Dr. Will Flanders, our guest from the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, talking about a documentary they've done on sort of keeping teachers around was some of the reasoning why they are leaving. And there's a lot of opinions. One of the texters just said, you asked me about teacher salaries. I don't care. Basically, I'm paraphrasing. But I think we should care because they're teaching your kids, first off. Any profession that requires, and I think we still have this in place, a college degree probably should be higher compensated than one that doesn't in most cases, right?
Well, just in also a stressful, hard job that is has big ramifications on the outcomes of kids.
Because one of the reasons I love the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty and your fearless leader, Rick Essenberg, is that you don't just say stuff. You give us ideas on implementation of an action plan that could actually try to fix this. So let's hit on some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a bill that was known as the Teacher Bill of Rights the legislative session currently that the governor has unfortunately vetoed. His arguments were that we weren't doing enough for mental health, and this was an unfunded mandate. We can discuss some of those things as well. But I think, some of the solutions that were in that legislation maybe could be brought back individually. I think the first thing is, strengthening teachers' authority in the classroom. The bill would have required that teachers can remove violent or disruptive students and ensure they...
Why is that not the case?
Well, there are a lot of issues that come into play with that, right? But I think a lot of this is within the school. They have an incentive to keep the number of incidents down. That goes for suspensions and expulsions, but also just even a behavior that they're, notifying parents about and things of that nature.
Is it for legal reasons?
When you get into disability and things like that, then it's for legal reasons. Beyond that, it's sort of just for,
appearance sake.
Appearance sake is a big driver right. At that point, I think. Yeah. But also, you think about parents, and we can't say parents are absolved of responsibility as well. No one likes to hear their kid is misbehaving. No one likes to think their kid's being singled out for misbehavior. So that's a driver as well.
Although
that's,
argue.
That's the meme, right? As far as when I was a kid, the parents looking at the kids being like, why'd you get a B? And now it's the parents looking at the teachers being like, why did she get a B?
Yes. Perfectly stated. Yes, exactly right. That's the new reality. And I hate it. I absolutely hate that. Parents, if you want better schools, support the teachers, support the school district. If you fight with them constantly and just take your kids' side, you think you're being a great parent, but you're actually hurting them, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And it's all context. We can talk about grade inflation, right? Part of that is driven by schools wanting to have high graduation rate, but part of it's driven by parents not wanting to see a C or D, as you just sort of stated there.
Or get their kid into the best school
possible.
Yeah.
Exactly. Some of the other things that, we included there, that there should be a requirement for classroom reentry plans. So we just discussed in the previous segment, kids coming immediately back into the classroom. Certainly for profound or severe misbehavior, we ought to have a idea in place of how we're going to bring this kid back into the classroom rather than just sort of immediately doing it. Letting parents be informed. We just talked about, the parents may be on the wrong side, but parents also deserve to know what's going on in classroom.
Absolutely.
And sometimes there's not a requirement
yes.
there as well. So those are three of the ideas we have currently.
So is there an idea that the Teacher Bill of Rights, because I think Louisiana has this, right? And
sure.
They really let teachers like it.
Yes.
And so as far as who brought forward the bill this last time, was it a teacher lobbied bill, or as far as getting more support for it, if it were to be reintroduced in the next session, what more support do you think it would need to get through?
Yeah, so I think this is an area where we see sort of a wedge between teachers on the ground and the teachers' union sometimes. There is a notion that some of the stuff isn't the most politically correct, right? That we are trying to enforce discipline, and we all like the notion of classrooms where we might have a kumbaya sort of environment, right? So teachers on the ground see the problems, but teachers' unions sometimes have been oppositional in some aspects of this. We did have teachers individually that were willing to speak out in support, like you saw in the documentary there as well. So I think getting more teachers on board and explaining what the components of this legislation would be, or as I said, pairing them out and doing them, individually as different pieces of legislation, I think that would be a key to building support, because we do want to know that this will actually help teachers on the ground in the classrooms be more effective.
Dr. Will Flanders, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, will throw some Will headlines at you.
Yeah.
Including food trucks. I didn't see that one coming.
I did not see that coming, but I'm here to talk about it.
Yeah. Mr. Smart Guy, you're going to get all the questions from Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. Point taken, 620 WTMJ. Quick break. All right, Dr. Will Flanders from Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. All right, ripped from the headlines, this food truck lawsuit from your organization on behalf of the owner of the Fatty Patty food truck. It's sort of an interesting. You said you were surprised by this.
Well, not surprised so much as, I guess, let me put it a different way. I'm against the food trucks having to shut down. I think that's not an actual solution. I don't think it's going to get us to where we need to go. And I think it's wildly unfair to the food trucks. And I didn't know there was a legal argument to make as far as what standing they have to actually argue that this is illegal. And so I was a little surprised when Will decided to take this up. But here we are, Will's defending the right to make a living for these food trucks.
Obviously, it's maybe not in the comfort zone of our case, our typical cases too much. But I think when you look at a lot of the stuff we've done over the years, we do support economic freedom, right? We believe in the ability of people to make a living, as you say, and to do whatever job in whatever manner they see fit that doesn't violate anybody else's rights. So, you know, I think this seemed like a perfect opportunity to sort of showcase that, certainly, and to get involved in an issue that, yeah, maybe a little outside of our comfort zone, but not, definitely is aligned with our general beliefs.
So will Evan Goyke have to be the one to defend this? Is that who you guys will be up against?
So I'd have to leave that one to lawyers and see what's going to go there. But it may lead to some interesting mashups there.
You know, one of the things that, first of all, I agree with Kristen. I think this is dumb to shut these businesses down, essentially, to try to fix something else. But people always ask me, why are you a supporter of Will? And I say I am. I have Rick on the show many times. I have you on the show and a lot of your other folks who work there. You cast a broad nets when you take on cases or you argue, and we're not all going to agree on this stuff, but that's a good thing. And it's a celebration of an organization, I think, stepping up for people. Some people you may not even like, but they generally pretty consistent on what they argue, whether it's political freedom or in this case economic freedom. That's why I support Will.
Well, yeah, thank you for that, and I think that's certainly our aspiration, right? Is to you know, obviously we have a set of beliefs. We have, we have principles that we stick to. Oftentimes, you know, those principles may align more with one side than the other, but, sometimes there's crossover and, you know, we sort of stick to the principles wherever they lead us. Even if some folks on the left may not think that's always the case, we generally try to, adhere to those principles wherever they take us.
All right.
Sure.
I have to call you out because I actually think I agree with you, but
oh, another one.
You tweeted out you not impressed with cursive mandates.
Yeah, so this is one where I will diverge even from some of our friends in the legislature in recent years. I try to look at the data, right? Because that's my role at Will, is to be the data person. And I'm not convinced by the research that's out there that there's a huge benefit to cursive writing versus just writing in general.
Give me the argument on that, because I'm a fan of typing.
I think there is data,
certainly,
right? Like actually
putting
pen to paper is different cognitively.
That's
but
right.
You're saying cursive versus print doesn't make a difference.
Exactly. And, okay. I haven't seen many studies that really parse that out. I'm usually, I'm happy to have my mind change if someone can show me convincing evidence.
Maybe someone's doctoral thesis could be on that.
That's true. There's an opportunity for someone out there.
Yeah, we just gave them some information. A quick story. When I was doing my grad school entrance forms, they have you write a paragraph or two in cursive. I had to think long and hard how that looked because I print everything.
Oh.
Surprise!
The nuns didn't force you to do cursive. Just
I did
beat
cursive,
that into your
but
little
I was
hand.
Never a great cursive writer. Okay. I can't even read my own printing.
My cursive is limited to my signature. That's about all I've retained from my cursive.
All right, Dr. Will Flanners, always enjoy your visits. We were talking about some Brewers. He's a big Brewers fan, big baseball fan. Smart guy. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, lots more to get to, including that big school board meeting in Watertown last night.
Spicy.
We'll dig into that one after the news, which is next on 620 WTMJ.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
You know, it's interesting when these kinds of stories get flagged, because as anyone who is listening to this show regularly, you know that the documentary I'm working on is how polarization and culture wars and tribalism has impacted Gen Z, because you can make the argument dating back to 2010, but certainly since 2016, it feels like a lot of polarization, but also a lot of these things that people get very emotional over playing out at the school level, at the college level. And this Watertown story is just another example of that. And so if you were not up to speed, although I feel like this has gotten a fair amount of news coverage so far.
A lot of attention. Nationally, too.
In Watertown, not so far from here, there was a orchestra. There is an orchestra at the high school that was going to play a song called, where is the actual?
A Mother of a Revolution.
A Mother of a Revolution. It is, there's no words, but it is a tribute to Martha P. Johnson, who is credited to being the first person to throw the first stone at Stonewall, which is largely the beginning of the LGBTQ civil rights movement, I think is a fair way to describe
that,
right? So she's kind of an icon in the LGBTQ rights movement as far as people looking to her, as far as what she stands for. And from what it sounds like, the orchestra teacher followed policy as far as alerting all of the parents of students in the orchestra.
She did follow policy. She sent the notification out.
Is it she or he? Samuel?
It's a her, right? It's a woman. I believe it's a woman. I could be wrong.
Okay.
But they followed policy.
The orchestra teacher followed policy. Three parents opted to have their child not play this song. The song apparently is a very technically difficult song to learn and to play. And the school board of Watertown caught wind of it. And in the past couple days, there's been more news coverage of it. Oh, are we playing it?
This is the song.
Just a taste.
Okay. All right, I'm going to keep talking. And so yesterday the school board voted on this, and it was 7-1. And so I know that we have a lot of audio of it, but it sounds like it was pretty
contentious.
There was a lot of
yelling.
Protesting. There was a lot of yelling. And so let's play a little bit of this from yesterday. Oh. Maybe that.
And not just grooming sexually, grooming politically as well. We should not be training little liberals and calling kids.
So that was one of the school board members saying, like, obviously, I think what the overall consensus was, it sounds like, that the people who on the school board said that they ran on not allowing indoctrination and that this was a prime example of indoctrination happening in schools. And so they voted 7-1 to remove the piece from the May 18th concert.
Okay, so a couple things. And I'm gonna stay on sort of the way that this was both the law, the way their rules are written and how the policies were followed. As we said, teacher followed the right parent notification. Apparently, only three people said they were offended by it and don't want you to do this. Nothing from anybody else, I'm assuming. But the three number was cited on the TMJ4 report that I watched this morning. The Watertown School Board policy, school district policy 2240, allows discussion of controversial issues, but prohibits content that undermines, this is a big one, religious beliefs or imposes values hostile to parents' beliefs. So on the notification, I don't think you can qualify it as hostile because only three people objected out of all of those students.
In a fairly conservative area. I'm guessing a lot of the parents are not radical liberals.
And again, there's no words in this music.
Yes.
So the indoctrination part, I'm not sure what that means. It's sort of a twisted way to make an argument. Whenever I hear someone in a school board setting start defining people by their political ideology, you lost me. That should not be part of this. It's not a political conversation. Did they follow the policy, and is the school board going to support their own policy? And on at least one of these, they did, and one they probably didn't. So you can make a religious argument against LGBTQ rights, probably in some form or fashion, because there's a million different religions in this world, and certainly in our state. But on the other one, they followed the policy. The teacher did what they're supposed to do, and there was no significant objection, which gets to the theater part of this. I understand the right of parents to speak at meetings, but when you use it as a forum for nonsense or to blow up the other political side, I'm sorry, I just have no use for it.
But this isn't coming organically from parents. This is this is the school board overstepping their bounds.
They essentially violated their own policy.
And you know, and so some of the other quotes from last night was from Christina DeGrave, which is one of the board members. Political violence should not be celebrated through music or song. Pretty sure our national anthem, pretty violent. And so I'm not sure that is the reason you're not a fan of this song. And 1812 Overture, you think that has any connotations to a war? And so I just don't think it's a bad, like some of these arguments are bad faith. And The board clerk, Tammy Fournier, said, I do think everyone should be appalled, but it should be at your music teacher. And I just, I don't know how long it's going to take people to understand that music doesn't make you gay, that music doesn't make you trans, that this is not something that you can indoctrinate someone into a different sexual orientation or a different gender identity. And that this is not, like, just removing a song for any of these kids who have feelings of how they're going to end up living their life as an adult, you removing this song isn't going to change that. And I don't know how much fear-mongering that these close-minded people think that they can, what they think is protecting kids is just close-minded bigotry, and you're taking away, you're overstepping your bounds into school policy when no one had a problem with it except three parents who already took their kid out.
What do you make of the fact that they're not even supporting their own teacher with this decision? Because this teacher followed the policy, and then he just discarded it like it didn't matter. So it's not even a great look, because most school boards that I know, I've talked to a lot of members because I'm doing some reporting away from the show, support their teachers. It's a bad look. Again, this is the bigger story. I know we're going to move on to other stuff. The politicization of school boards, I know some parents think this is a win. It's not a win. It dumbs down the process. I'm not against parents speaking, but when you politicize your comments or politicize schooling and education, you lose me. And you're making education, the education of students, more difficult. And if you want a student to really be the smartest, most culturally aware students you could ever have, and that should be your kid, you're going to want to have them not just be exposed to things that you think are proper, but to things that maybe you don't even know about, or because that's most the case. Most parents don't know about the things their kids are learning. Let's be honest. They don't know to the level that the teachers do, and they probably, their kids know more than they do. Let's be honest about it.
Well, but also an important part of this is that there wasn't part of learning this song in their orchestra class. There wasn't curriculum around Stonewall.
No, there was nothing.
Right? Like, it was just learning the song, and there was an acknowledgement of where the song came from, but there wasn't a history lesson of LGBTQ movement and what Stonewall was.
And my question for the school board in Watertown, you're going to change your policy because you undermine one of the principal values of it, which is asking for parental notification. You got 3 out of, I don't know how, dozens probably.
There's like 40 students in the orchestra.
That doesn't suggest a consensus to me. Quick break. I would call it an orchestral arrangement of that song, wouldn't you? I mean, it was a challenging song, I guess, to learn to play. So we're talking about the Watertown. We're going to move on, but that's the piece.
Are you a symphony fan?
I actually like symphonic music, yeah. I listen to opera, too. I mean, I have a pretty wide... I just interviewed a hip-hop guy the other...
Really?
Yeah,
who?
Greg Marshall.
Oh, yeah. Ahead of his one-man show?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Didn't you go to the one-man show?
I have not, but I watched some of it.
Okay.
Yeah, and he just did something here at Third Street Market Hall. I don't know if you caught some of that.
I was not here when he did that,
where his whole... completely ad-libbed, where he creates a song about the people who are watching the show, and they don't know that they're part of the song until he starts talking about him. I mean, that's some guts. I mean, dude. He called it, he said he had a blast doing it was the longest podcast I've ever done, was plus 30, which is pretty long. But he said it was a rapid fire, much fun conversation about all the things he's involved in, which is brand marketing, mm-hmm. and he's obviously music is and theater is sort of his background. Father of 4 daughters, which is fascinating to me. I did not know that. So that'll be on an upcoming edition of the...
So that's not out yet?
Not out yet. It'll be out in probably... It's going to be a while because we're sort of stacked up. But a fascinating conversation. Derek Van Orden.
We don't talk about him that much.
No.
I mean, it's...
I don't find him that interesting.
His district is outside of our immediate listening area. Doesn't mean that we don't have people over there who listen to our show. But very important seat. Arguably the most competitive seat in any of the congressional seats in Wisconsin. Yeah. And... He's won twice now on pretty thin margins as far as and is a big Trumper. I think that's probably easy to say.
Big fan. Yeah, he talks to the president quite a bit, apparently.
And although I will say the after the State of the Union, that video of him kind of following Trump around, trying to shake his hand afterwards, and Trump just kind of ignoring him was funny. You needed some like Curb Your Enthusiasm music behind that. All right. So I saw this headline from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and I wonder how much this will end up being a problem for him, because as did all of the Republicans in Wisconsin, they all voted for the Big Beautiful Bill. Right. And we know that part of the Big Beautiful Bill is major cuts to Medicaid and Medicare that don't go into effect until 2027.
Yeah, it's like a trillion dollars.
Yeah.
Nearly a trillion.
And so over the last week, there were some protests happening in his district. And Van Orden gave a response to WXOW in La Crosse talking about the protesters who had been critical of the fact that he voted for a bill that was going to cut Medicaid and Medicare. And this was his answer.
It's a banned piece with
no
lyrics.
That's the wrong one. Where is, here we go. Van Orden and
the American citizens have the right to peacefully protest. They get to make their voices heard. I just wish they knew what they were talking about. There has been no cuts to Medicaid or Medicare. There's not going to be cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. What's going to end, though, is the rampant waste, fraud, and abuse.
So my question is he convinced that there actually is not going to be cuts to Medicaid and Medicare, or is he lying?
He's playing the Trump game, which is say whatever you want. We'll see how it shakes out. He's using the fact that there's no cuts currently because
there's not
delayed. He may be playing around with the idea that at some point this will be revisited, because that's sort of that was a talking point for both sides for a while. These cuts are going to be reexamined. We're going to, because Americans are hurting, all that stuff. So he's playing the Trump game. Say whatever you want, deny the existence of reality in many cases, because it's not a debatable topic. Eventually, there will be nearly $1 trillion for Medicaid, including work requirement, all these other things. But
so
the other piece,
there's $1 trillion for Medicaid, yes. And then the Congressional Budget Office estimates more than $900 billion in Medicaid over the next decade. And $500 billion in Medicare yearly automatically cuts over the next decade.
He's also deflecting. And I'm the first one, because I've been saying this for years. There's a lot of fraud in many, many governmental programs. Detecting it, enforcing the rules, and getting the bad actors, difficult process.
Also expensive.
Very expensive. So to sort of shift the attention of that, which is sort of a noble way to avoid the direct question, is something that's also a game that's played by a lot of politicians, especially on my side. I don't like it, but he is literally not telling the truth, although a delayed reality for him, I guess. He can sort of sit here now and say, nothing's happening right now. I guess that would be his argument. But in a year or so, nearly $1 trillion in Medicaid cuts. And let's be honest about who that helps. Poor people. People that need health services. We're already talking about rural health being at its most critical moment, junction right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of hospital closures in his district.
And that's not a debatable topic, because included in this, I think in the BBB, was $50 billion for rural health care. So I guess was it, we'll cut $1 trillion, we'll give you $50 billion to sort of make you feel better about it. Is that the
Well, that was
the
actually
magic?
Part of the under-babied conversation yesterday.
Yeah.
That was part of the maternal mortality conversation, that some of the money for that $50 billion rural health care was going to go towards those programs. But those are also one-time payments versus ongoing, you know, because most of the rural health care, a lot of their money comes from Medicaid reimbursements.
Yeah.
And so this is something that in the next 10 years, if it's not curbed, people in his district are going to feel. And so it's interesting to me as far as his bold face, either a lie or he's convinced himself in how he answered that question, that these protesters don't understand the situation. And if that will actually come to fruition in this election, once the district, so the challenge in for the Democrats, there's Rebecca Cook, who this is her third time running, and then Emily Burge, which I think that could end up being closer than people think, even though Rebecca Cook's been running for as long as she has. I think there's a lot of support for Emily, too, so it'll be interesting to see what happens in that primary. And then one of them will run against him, and it'll be interesting to see how much this comes up in that campaign.
And it, like many races, it hinges on how many Democrats turn out for this response to what they feel is happening to this country as a result of Trump's policies. So, yeah. Lots to talk about. We'll continue the conversation on Point Taken after this. All right. So coming up in the last half hour of the Wednesday program, we're going to talk about what's looming over the state of Wisconsin. We're going to have a tax deal or not. What's going to happen? Apparently, a vote's today, I guess, if they get around to it.
Sounds like it. Sounds like both chambers are supposed to happen today.
And then we'll close it out for this Wednesday with our we're sort of honoring Salute to Service from in a perspective of where we're heading into Heroes Week next week, which we reveal our five honorees for this year. And thanks to Waterstone Bank and Mission 94 and all our great partners to make that possible. So we're going to celebrate one of our honorees from last year, pastor from Norway Fire Department, Chaplin.
Chaplin. Yeah. I remember this interview. He was wonderful.
Yeah, so we're going to play that feature for you at the end of the show today. And always enjoy him. And we are in the process of completing our interviews for the final five. It's always arduous, busy week. That's why I was so grouchy this morning, because there's a lot going on.
That's why?
One of many reasons why the Stever late in life is very grouchy and can be, but also can be fun, as you know.
I get you there. I feel like I make you more fun. I think I know how to walk the line in
look
your
at you
temperament.
Patting yourself on
yeah,
the back.
Yeah, I think I'm a Steve
you.
Whisperer. That's
all
what
right.
they call me.
Let's not whisper. Let's go to the news, ABC. All right, final half hour. Point taken. Sort of the way I look at this show is, one, I enjoy doing it with you, Kristen Bryant, because you're talented, funny, and all the things we've talked about endlessly, probably too much. but we cut through the BS, and I know you want to talk about this tax.
No, I mean, because I think we're certainly going to have more to talk about tomorrow as we see what happens.
Because it
may or may not be a done deal, right? Because there ended up being a lot more Democrats coming out against the bill, the negotiation and the deal that was a compromise between Governor Evers, Robin Voss, and Devin Lemieux. Tom Tiffany, also not a fan. I think the headline or the article from Molly Beck and Jesse Apoyan from Journal Sentinel is like, why the backlash? And like, was this a little bit of an editorial comment from these two straight shooter journalists? But I think they called a spade that it's politics, because it seems like on its face, as you've said before, a lot of different people are getting something out of this deal.
Yeah.
Schools, people who work overtime and tip and get tips, people who are just going to get a rebate. Is it perfect? Is it potentially cashing a check before you have it? Maybe there's some criticisms, but the largest criticisms coming from people who would have the most to gain if this money were there, if and when they get elected.
Yeah.
Or can campaign on this. And so Molly and Jesse basically said this morning is like, why is this happening? Like, politics. And so is that what's happening? I don't know. Maybe. But also, do they have the votes? I don't know.
I don't know either.
But it's happening today, apparently, with both chambers.
Yes. And I said this morning to you before the show. This is a living, live example of why I hate politics, even though I talk about politics for a living. Because all the mindless, moronic comments going over social media and commentary on Squawk Radio on what should happen. This is an example, my opinion, and mine only, probably I'm in the minority here, of how government should work. You're not getting everything you want. Your side doesn't have all the answers. The other side's not evil. A governor of one party worked with a legislature of another party and got something done for taxpayers, residents, citizens of Wisconsin. And anybody who complains about this, and I'm not saying you can't complain, you have every right to complain. If you're elected, that's your job. Candidates, you might want to think about a different way to approach this, because you're just blowing up everything. Because whatever they would have done, they would have complained, because they're all trying to make, on the Democratic side, trying to make a name for themselves.
So what do you make of the fact that it wasn't just Dianne Hesselbein? Well, in the Joint Finance Committee yesterday, all four of the Democrats voted no.
Yeah.
Not just Kelda.
Yeah, I don't care.
No, I know. But it's like, do you think this is just politics, or do you think there is actual legitimate criticisms coming from Democrats as far as what the deal could be versus what it is?
Any criticism that says what it could be is aspirational and probably not realistic in the climate that we live in. So I don't care. This is something done by, again, I'm going to reiterate what I just said. Democratic governor, very liberal governor, very conservative.
Is he very liberal?
Oh, come on.
I don't, I mean, I, maybe I live in a different world than you. Very liberal to me is something different than
All right, I'll remove
Tony
the
Evers.
Qualifier. Liberal governor, Tony Evers. Good?
Yeah.
Compromise and bipartisanship is hard. This idea that some of the Democratic candidates, everybody but Missy Hughes, right? Missy Hughes was on board.
Missy Hughes was on board. Yeah. Well, and Sarah Rodriguez and Mandela Barnes' statements on it were like, kind of said it's not perfect,
nuanced.
But it's something.
Yeah.
I think Crowley's was also, it's not perfect, but it's something. Kelda was a hard no. Fran was a hard no. I think Brennan was a hard no. Yeah.
Tiffany was no because it doesn't help him politically.
Banks said was a no.
Yeah, exactly. I want people to understand the way I feel about this, and maybe it's just me shouting it at the sky. I don't know. This is what's wrong with politics. So you can assess these candidates on one side or Tom Tiffany on the other side, but what I think school districts, taxpayers, citizens get from this is something for their money, some actual action that doesn't just continue the squawk parade, right? Because we're really good at that. Both in the media and both in the elected official world and governments, we're really good at squawking about politics. Every mindless knucklehead on social media has a take on politics, often uneducated, uninformed. But it's your take, your opinion, so God bless you. I don't need it anymore. And this is me showing my age. I'm just done with it. I'm absolutely done with it.
How are you going to do this show if you're done with
it? That's a great effing question. Put that on the video. I
Block
don't know. Because this is what.
Because you were frustrated. I mean, you were. I think that
I'm
also you have a lot of on your plate right now. But like, you were really angry this morning. And that is a question as far as like some doing this show is part of dealing with the noise and analyzing the noise and the policy and not being so rattled by it that you raise your blood pressure.
My blood pressure is fine. But what I will say to you is for those folks who want an honest opinion about politics, and I am patting myself on the back. I don't play favorites. I'm a Republican, but I blow up Republicans. I blow up Democrats. I don't play favorites. You need to be smarter than that as a listener and as a voter and as a resident. If you're going to play this stupid game of politics like they're trying to play, you get what you get. So stop bitching about it. Stop bitching about it because you earned this. You're going to put these people in. If you are objecting to compromise and bipartisanship, you are the problem. I think that's how I'm going to rectify or explain my next year or so doing this job. How's that for you?
What do you think? If you were wagering, you think it gets approved?
I hope so, yes.
I think the Republicans probably have the votes. Even if every Democrat votes against it, I think they probably... Because the only other Republican in that I saw criticize it, at least publicly, was Nass.
Yeah.
And well, so if there's...
Shall see. Plenty for us to talk about, including on Friday with Bill and Joe.
I know.
Wonder what they're going to say. Kind of already know what they're going to say. Quick break. After the break, salute to service. Every year when we do our Waterstone Bank WTMJ salute to service, in the week before Heroes Week, which we're working on right now, we're going to put those five great stories. And they're all different, life-saving.
I don't know any of them yet. You have not shared with me.
That's what I want to do that differently because I want you to be surprised because there's legacy stories where, in one case, a firefighter, his father and great-grandfather were firefighters. Delivered a baby on the job like last week. I mean, it's just cool stuff. Life-saving in the Milwaukee Fire Department, volunteer. It's just everyone's different. But we always, the week before, share our stories from last year. And this was a really good, because I remember you saying you liked this.
This guy was great.
He's such a great chaplain. He's Mark Jaramillo from the Norway Fire Department. He's their chaplain. And it is a fantastic story of public service, first responders, and somebody who does something to help those individuals cope with the things they have to deal with every day.
Hi, I'm Christy Jaramillo. I'm nominating my husband, Mark Jaramillo, for the salute to service.
Hi, I'm Mark Jaramillo. I am the chaplain with the Norway Fire Department.
I think he's one of the most giving people I've ever known in my life.
I've actually been a pastor coming up on 30 years, and very proud that 27 of those years have actually been with my wife as colleagues, and this absolutely shapes everything that I am, do, and how I even relate to this world.
He is always going. He's always trying to find the next way, the better way to help people. And once he connected with the firefighter community out here, he just knew that he had to connect in the full capacity.
If I'm going to be a pastor, if I'm going to be anybody, I have to be authentic. And because of that, I've always looked at what can I do to make a difference. 2011, I was approached by the chief of Norway Fire Department, and he looked at me and said, do you want to be a chaplain? I looked at him and I went, well, what the heck does that mean? He goes, I don't know, but we'll figure it out together. And at that point, I had a pretty amazing experience just getting to be part of the department, but I quickly learned that for first responders, if you really truly want to be a part of their world, and if you want them to be able to trust you, you have to be one of them.
So he did all the training.
I ended up getting my certification as a firefighter, and then shortly after that, I became an EMT. And that was probably the best gift I could give to myself. Not only did I learn new skills, but it allowed me to really walk with people, particularly our first responders and all the stuff they have to deal with.
It's been a little crazy around here to juggle everything.
I work with not only Norway Fire Department, but I have Waterford, Tishigan, Burlington, and all of those departments, as well as the sheriffs and police departments, have consistently sent me people to help, or people to talk to, or people who just want to have a person to reflect with.
The things he can do in a conversation now, he can help people tell their stories in a way that can help them get through it, whatever it is.
It's enhanced everything. And I can say that because my job as a pastor is to bring a real experience of life, but I have to bring it in a very real context, real way, in a real world with very real eyes. I don't wear rosy-colored glasses. As a leader, I have to live the life that I keep asking them to live, which is a life that's fruitful, productive, as well as loving. It doesn't surprise me when maybe 2 or 3 months after I've helped them dealing with a stroke or some kind of crisis, they show up at my church and they're like, I know you.
What does salute to service mean to you?
I'm humbled. Brother, I'm a grunt. Whenever I heard from my wife that this was an honor given to me, I'm like, come on. I see our sheriffs, our police, our dispatchers, our hospital employees. I see what they go through. And I can tell you, these are amazing people. The medics, the EMTs, all of them. Their love and commitment to this community transcends any kind of award that I could see. So for me to get this, good Lord, I don't know. I can't believe I got it. I'll stop there.
And as I always love to say, we can't do it without the help of our great partners, and two of them. There's many partners this year, but this is presented, Salute to Service presented by Waterstone Bank, who've been with me for years. And a new partner that's joined into the action, sponsored by Mission 94, great partner as well. Couldn't do it without them. So I look forward to sharing those stories next week during Heroes Week right here on 620 WTMJ. That's a great one.
That's a good one.
I love the emotion in his voice. He's a good guy, too. Quick break here on Point Taken. Ooh, has a busy show today. Thanks for Will Flanders. Beyond his smarts, he's just a fun guy. And we kind of hurried him in because he got here a little late, and not because of his fault. We have tremendous security protocols that we always have to follow. I hope the bosses are listening, that we always follow those security protocols whenever possible, making that part of our mantra, our daily mission statement. But I love smart people that can relate their wisdom to the audience. And we got great people. One said superb conversation. Mm-hmm. Love that. We don't get a lot of superbs, but I'll take a superb when it's handed to me. So he was talking obviously about the education. That's something we're always going to be focused on. It's one of our like principal subjects because it matters. I mean, your child is going to be going into the school system pretty soon. You're going to have a lot to say about that and how things go and how those school boards interact with parents and teachers and students and even things like smartphone policy, how that's going to shape your life, because I know you're a scroller.
I am a scroller.
And what are you going to do with that information, knowing how you are when your child is at some point faced with that reality and education?
When the hypocrisy of...
Yeah.
Why do you spend so much time on your phone and I'm not allowed to have one?
I just don't...
I think I have a couple of years before I have to have an answer for that.
Correct. If I told you this yesterday, just because sometimes I forget what I say to you. Some of it's off air and some of it's on air. I'm so proud of myself that I went from 8+ hours a day of screen time to 3-something. It was like just under 4. I'm proud of myself.
You should be proud of yourself.
And I think as much as people love this stuff, the Facebooks and the Twitters and going and watching reels, I know they're entertaining. I just don't think they're good for you.
Well, I mean, there's research that what short-form video is doing to our brains. Yeah. And so that is for real.
Them, yeah.
There's a new article from The Verge that I think at some point, either for an overtime or later this week or next week, we can talk about like the clipification of everything.
Love
of the
that.
Fact that people aren't watching the whole show or listening to the whole podcast. Or I mean, I had someone say that to me a couple weeks ago when I was at the Electing Women thing. Someone says, like, I love your show. And I go, oh, do you listen? He goes, well, I don't listen to the podcast, but I see your clips on Instagram.
Yeah, exactly.
And on the one hand, you're like, all right, well, like, it's kind of evidence that maybe we should be clipping more from the show because it's more brand awareness. It's more people knowing what we're talking about and people who are maybe never going to actually have the time to add the podcast to their roundup of shows that they listen to. But it's also how you get to things out of context and just little bitty bites versus a nuanced, longer conversation. And so I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is certainly a thing.
You know, culture changes and how we consume news, where we get news. All those things are rapidly changing in this country from what I grew up with three networks, basically, which provided half hour long news programs every night. That's all we had before CNN. I'm old enough to be that guy. It's changed. And how we sort of figure that out so that we're smarter at the end of it, or more aware of each other, and that means supporting other people that maybe you don't agree with on occasion. That's part of this process. Can't wait for tomorrow. Jeremy Janine joins us, and maybe we'll have a vote that we can talk about in the Wisconsin State Legislature. How about that?
I would imagine we will.
All right. We'll see. Tomorrow.